Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is side one of For the Record program number 510, titled Deadly Echoes, I Told You So, Part 2. This has been recorded on May 8th of the year 2005. We are celebrating the 60th anniversary of the end of World War II in Europe, and what I'm going to be doing in this program is jumping back not 60 years but 5 years in time, where we're going to be taking a look at some information that I presented in For the Record program number 248. That program was recorded on September 4th of the year 2000. That was Labor Day weekend of 2000, the formal kickoff of the 2000 presidential campaign. And in For the Record program 248, titled Bushed, the Political Heritage of George W., I noted the fact that the people who were advising and running with George Walker Bush were people basically who had served in his father's administration. And in turn, I took a look at the Bush family history, and on the basis of these historical elements, predicted or foreshadowed what I felt would probably be happening in the course of a Bush administration. Now we know Bush administrations. What we're going to be doing in this program is jumping back to For the Record 248, which in turn excerpted a number of other For the Record programs done in 1998, 99, and 2000. And we're going to be taking a look at what I had feared would be taking place in a Bush administration, and we're going to be taking a look at how so many of the events and circumstances that have manifested themselves during the Bush administrations were foreshadowed in For the Record 248. I want to stress before we launch right into the main body of the material, this is not an exercise in egotism or self-righteousness, but rather I can appreciate how for many listeners, particularly newer and younger listeners, what I have to say would sound frankly crazy. They think, well, this guy is whacked. I mention what we're engaging in, what we're going to be engaging in, so that people can perhaps understand that things that may seem out of the question when they hear them now may very well become true in a devastating fashion later. What we're going to begin with is looking at the relationship between the Bush family and the Bin Laden family. And as is the case with all of the items we're going to be hearing, take a look at what I was saying on September 4th of 2000 and see if you don't see some deadly echoes of what I said then taking place today. The following excerpt is from For the Record program number 182. One of the aspects of George W.'s career that should be reflected on in connection with the petroleum industry and George Sr. is the fact that an individual who apparently worked for George Sr., James R. Bath, was one of the investors in Arbusto Energy, George W.'s oil company, and it appears that some of the startup capital for Arbusto Energy may very well have come from the family of Osama bin Laden, the terrorist extraordinaire who's received a lot of press in the last several years. The following excerpt is from For the Record program number 182. In 1999, there was a biography published of George W. Bush entitled Fortunate Son, subtitled George W. Bush and the Making of an American President, that authored by one J.H. Hatfield, published in hardcover by St. Martin's Press, copyright 1999. The biography was suppressed and recalled after it came out that J.H. Hatfield allegedly had a serious criminal record in Texas. What's interesting about this suppressed biography is that it documents connections between George W. Bush and his Arbusto Energy Company and the family of Osama bin Laden. The person who constituted the connections between those two families, the families of bin Laden and George W. Bush, is none other than James R. Bath, a Houston businessman with numerous interesting connections. Turning now to the book Fortunate Son, subtitled George W. Bush and the Making of an American President, we read of the forming of Arbusto. Like his father, who made his fortune in the oil business with the money of others, George W. founded Arbusto with the financial backing of investors including James R. Bath, B-A-T-H, a Houston businessman whom Bush apparently first met when they were in the same Texas Air National Guard unit. Tax documents and personal financial records show that Bath, an aircraft broker with ties to Saudi Arabia sheiks, had invested $50,000 in Arbusto, granting him a 5% interest in two limited partnerships controlled by Bush. In one of the most bizarre footnotes to history, Time magazine described Bath in 1991 as, quote, a deal broker whose alleged associations run from the CIA to a major shareholder and director of the Bank of Credit and Commerce, unquote. BCCI, as it was more commonly known, was closed down in July of 1991 amid charges of multi-billion-dollar fraud and worldwide news reports that the institution had been involved in covert intelligence work, drug money laundering, arms brokering, bribery of government officials, and aid to terrorists. An accounting commission by the Bank of England finally exposed the extent of BCCI's deficits and criminal offenses, forcing the bank's eventual collapse. I would note that the bank was used as a major vehicle for some of the Iran-Contra machinations by Oliver North and Company, those machinations directed by George Herbert Walker Bush, George W.'s father. Continuing, Bath was never directly implicated in the BCCI scandal, but according to the Outlaw Bank, an award-winning 1993 book by Time correspondents Jonathan Beatty and S.C. Gwynn, Bath originally, quote, made his fortune by investing money for Sheikh Khalid bin Mahfouz and another BCCI-connected Saudi, Sheikh bin Laden, unquote, allegedly the father of none other than Osama bin Laden, the man accused by the U.S. government of masterminding the August 1998 terrorist bombings of the American embassies in Kenya and Tanzania, which killed more than 250 people. According to news reports, in a 1976 trust agreement drawn shortly after Bush's father was appointed director of the CIA, Saudi Sheikh Salem M. bin Laden appointed Bath as his business representative in Texas. Bin Laden, along with his brothers, owned Bin Laden Brothers Construction, one of the largest construction companies in the Middle East. Skipping down, Time reporters Beatty and Gwynn suggest in their book that the $50,000 Bath invested in George W.'s Arbusto Energy Drilling Company may have belonged to Bath's Saudi clients, since the Houston businessman, quote, had no substantial money of his own at the time, unquote. Ironically, the money used to underwrite the first business venture of a possible future president of the United States may have been derived at least in part from the family fortune of Saudi terrorist Osama bin Laden. That again from For the Record 248, excerpting For the Record 182. Note also in passing that the Salem bin Laden was Osama's brother, not his father. What I noted on Labor Day weekend of 2000 was that if you take George Bush, you'll get Osama bin Laden. Has that happened? Another thing I noted in For the Record 248 was, in an excerpt in turn from For the Record 174, that the elder George Bush, from whose advisory clique the younger George Bush's personnel were taken, was the master, literally presided over a series of governmental, interagency governmental networks that were created pursuant to the Vice President's Task Force on Combating Terrorism, that Vice President at the time being the elder George Bush, former director of the CIA. These interagency governmental networks were used to effect the Iraqgate and Iran-Contra machinations, becoming the elder George Bush's own private intelligence service. And again, this created sort of a governmental super agency that was completely outside the normal chain of command and constitutional authority. In our conversations with Daniel Hopsiger, specifically 482, For the Record 482, 483, and 484, and again in For the Record programs 498 and 499, we noted that many of the hijackers who infiltrated, the September 11th hijackers who infiltrated through Florida, infiltrated through a milieu that was inextricably linked with some of the derivatives of the Iran-Contra-related drug smuggling networks. So basically those networks were used as the vehicle through which many of the September 11th hijackers infiltrated. I also noted in For the Record program 248 and an excerpt from For the Record 228 that the elder George Bush figures in the bombing of Pan Am 103 investigation, and specifically, again, noting the presence of George Bush at a meeting in Jerusalem along with the late Amiram Nir Nisker and also the McKee team. I noted that the McKee team was on its way back to the United States on Pan Am 103 when they were killed in the bombing of Pan Am 103. They were allegedly returning to the U.S. with information on the complicity between the Iran-Contra team, again supervised by the elder George Bush, and drug trafficker, terrorist, and weapons dealer Manzer El-Kassar, himself implicated in the events surrounding the bombing of Pan Am 103. As we looked at in RFA programs numbers 35 and 38, the Pan Am 103 bombing not only involved some of the same elements as September 11th, some elements of U.S. intelligence, some elements of German intelligence, Islamists, and residual members of the underground Reich, but specifically a controlled drug delivery network appears to have been the vehicle through which the bomb was secreted on the Pan Am 103 in Frankfurt, Germany. Once again, it appears that some of these controlled drug delivery networks in the U.S. were the vehicle through which the September 11th hijackers infiltrated. And I would note in that context that Pan Am 103, the bombing of Pan Am 103, may very well have been a prelude to and or a template for September 11th. I would also note that the less than vigorous investigation of the bombing of Pan Am 103 was undertaken by none other than Robert Mueller, now head of the FBI, and again proving less than vigorous in the investigation of September 11th, as he did in the investigation of BCCI, the BCCI milieu inextricably linked with Iran-Contra and with the events surrounding September 11th. So I said basically on Labor Day weekend of 2000, if you take the younger George Bush, you're going to get the consequences of the elder George Bush's Iran-Contra legacy. Has that happened? Once again, from For the Record 248, excerpting For the Record 174. There's a good description in The Secret War Against the Jews of what basically became George Bush's own personal private spy agency. And again, this grew out of the Vice President's Task Force on Combating Terrorism and was one of the most important elements of American and world power politics in the 1980s and has not received the attention due it. Peter Dale Scott, the brilliant Berkeley professor, is one of the relatively few people to pay attention to this aspect of Iran-Contra, and it is absolutely pivotal. Although the CIA was involved, certainly, and the National Security Council was involved, certainly, and Oliver North was involved, certainly, they were not the main players, and George Bush, who claimed to be out of the loop, was basically the loop. He was the godfather of these operations, and the illegalities involved in Iran-Contra, from the cocaine trafficking to major violations of international law, and then on over to the Iraqgate scandal, the arming of Saddam Hussein, including the equipping him with CBW capability, now haunting our GIs in terms of Gulf War syndrome, or in the form of Gulf War syndrome. The criminality and the wrongdoing involved in the Iran-Contra and Iraqgate affairs continues to take lives in this and other countries and haunts this country as perhaps the single greatest nexus of illegality, even perhaps including the Kennedy assassination, although that certainly was a pivotal event. Loftus and Ahrens in The Secret War Against the Jews described the genesis of these interagency governmental networks that became George Bush's private intelligence service and which were the main vehicles for Iran-Contra and Iraqgate and, as we'll see, the Waco fiasco. And the Loftus and Ahrens described this as follows. One of the first things President Reagan did in 1981 was to dismantle Carter's National Security Council structure and install his own highly compartmentalized staff organization. The NSC was relegated to a harmless study group, while policy was made in a bewildering maze of separate and secret cells. One top-secret National Security Decision Directive, NSDD No. 3, established a new intelligence organization for Vice President George Bush. The former CIA director now had become the head of his own separate spy agency in the White House. And then there is a quote here. The Special Situations Group, SSG, chaired by the Vice President, is charged, inter alia, with formulating plans in anticipation of crises. In order to facilitate this crisis pre-planning responsibility, a Standing Crisis Pre-Planning Group, or CPPG, is hereby established and will, for each potential crisis, ensure that an interagency group is established and developing contingency plans. Provide guidance to the group and task it with the preparation of preemptive policy options to prevent a crisis if possible, as well as the preparation of political military plans for dealing with the eventual crisis. And then Loftus and Ahrens go on to comment about that excerpt from a document. It is clear from this top secret document that Bush asked for and received authorization to prepare preemptive policy options, unquote. If this sounds strikingly familiar to the preventive action, unquote, program of the Jonathan Institute, it is no coincidence. Bush intended to strike the first blow in the war on terrorism, having learned such strategies from the Israelis. In short, George Bush's job was to coordinate the State Department, CIA, military, and any other government agency in preparation for another terrorist attack
or hostage crisis. No one but Bush was responsible for the disasters to come. And I would add that even though he was formally out of office, that would include Waco. The Justice Department under George Bush, by the way, the last attorney general that he had was William Barr himself, a quote, ex-unquote CIA officer who formally left the agency at the same time as George Bush when Carter did not reappoint George Bush director of Central Intelligence. And the subordinates in charge of Waco will be the focus of later discussion. Continuing with the Loftus Aarons text, of course, as plans for dealing with the terrorists grew more ambitious, Bush's Special Situation Group needed a bigger staff. Bush's aide, Don Gregg, just could not do it all on his own. On May 14, 1982, the White House made another top-secret reorganization. A memo was sent to the Secretaries of State, Treasury, Defense, the Director of the CIA, and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. They were told that under Vice President Bush's SSG, there would be created a, quote, crisis pre-planning group, unquote, to handle the staff functions. The memo also announced that, quote, the first meeting of the CPPG is scheduled for Thursday, May 20th, 1982, in the White House Situation Room from 1,000 to 1,200. That would be the hours, by the way, in military time, 10 o'clock to noon. Agencies are requested to provide the name of their CPPG representative to Oliver North, NSC staff, and then gives his telephone number, unquote. During a television interview, Oliver North insisted that he had always worked for the NSC and denied having kept Vice President Bush briefed on his work. This was a lie. As the memo just cited shows, at least as early as May 14, 1982, North was already detailed from the NSC to work for Bush's CPPG. As a practical matter, the CPPG's staff work was done by an informal subgroup called the 208 Committee. Reagan had created a secret cell inside the White House separate from the normal command structure. Reagan was a nice old guy who read his scripts well. When it came to intelligence operations, he trusted Casey and Bush to tell him what to do. They were, after all, both heads of the CIA. If Bush wanted a new spy service, he got it. That did not go over well with the Secretary of State, George Shultz, who wrote a memo in protest on May 25, 1983, complaining that the structure of the Vice President's private intelligence organization was hampering the coordination of U.S. efforts in Central America. Reagan wrote a polite memo back to Shultz informing him that Bush's SSG-CPPG structure would stay the way it was and that Shultz should help make it work. An attached chart showed that Shultz's State Department was below the NSC, which was below the President. To the left of the NSC and above Shultz was Bush's SSG-CPPG apparatus. When it came to terrorism or the Contras, Bush's Special Situations Group had the final say. This last sentence again, because it's basically a thesis statement. When it came to terrorism or the Contras, and as we'll see later, Iraqgate, Bush's Special Situations Group had the final say. To put it bluntly, Bush was running a White House within the White House. Its members could co-opt or circumvent any government agency they wished. There would be no leaks, but unfortunately no independent criticism of their plans either. The Vice President's SSG was the perfect hiding place for some of the bizarre operations dreamed up by Bush, Casey, Robert Bud McFarlane, Dewey Claridge, and North. Our intelligence sources say that these five men are the morons, unquote, who bungled their way into the Iran-Contra affair and then tried to shift the blame to the National Security Council or to Israel, even to Ollie North, anywhere but back to the office of the Vice President. By the way, it should be known that there were even many people in the CIA who opposed a lot of the aspects of Iran-Contra. One should not, when looking at the U.S. intelligence community, assume it's a monolith. It's not, as I've stated in the past. Even the CIA is anything but monolithic, and there were many people within CIA who opposed the Bush plans and what Oliver North was doing. However, they were not to prevail. But one should bear in mind that there are many people within the CIA and other organizations who are genuine patriots, a badly abused term these days, and are not out to subvert this country, although there are also outright fascist elements within that and other government agencies who sadly have been allowed ascendancy. And I think much of the responsibility for that lies with the American people themselves and their casual aspect, the casual approach to absolutely vital political matters. Now, more about this private spy service, or White House within a White House, that George Bush was running, and it was the main vehicle, as we already looked at, for Iran-Contra. We're going to look at that some more in a minute. It also was the major vehicle for George Bush to get involved with the arming of Iraq. We're going to talk about that, too. According to Alan Friedman's book, Spider's Web, oh, by the way, returning to The Secret War Against the Jews by Loftus and Ahrens, according to Alan Friedman's book, Spider's Web, Vice President Bush played a covert role in Casey's Iraq initiative. This was the initiative to arm Iraq against Iran in the Iran-Iraq war. Continuing, like Perry's discussion of Cambodia, Friedman makes a powerful case that Bush was inextricably intertwined with Casey's bizarre initiative to buy Iraqi oil and Hussein's allegiance with guns. There is no doubt that transferring American weapons to Iraq was highly illegal, but was approved by both Bush and Casey. It was also hidden from both the Secretary of State and Congress. Both times Casey and Bush teamed up, the operation involved gun running. It is no coincidence that both secret operations began in 1982, the same year that Vice President Bush established his Special Situations Group for Counterterrorism. What neither Perry, that's Mark Perry, the author of Eclipse, The Last Days of the CIA, nor Friedman realized was that Bush and Casey worked together on a third covert operation, the Arms for Hostages deal with Iran. According to our sources, the story of Bush's role as the secret architect of Irangate has never been told before. It was run just as poorly as the Cambodian gun running and just as illegal as the arming of Iraq, but it was much better hidden from Congress.
That again from For the Record program number 174. As I'm recording this on September 6th, of the year 2000, the trial of a couple of Libyans accused in the bombing of Pan Am Flight 103 is underway and yet stalled because there is a dispute about some CIA cables concerning the informant, the CIA informant, a Libyan allegedly working for Libyan intelligence, who had provided information to the CIA about the alleged Libyan role in the bombing of Pan Am 103. As we're going to see, and as we looked at in great detail in Radio Free America shows 35 and 38, there's a profound connection between the Iran-Contra scandal and the bombing of Pan Am 103. And, not too surprisingly, there is also a very interesting connection of George Bush, or between George Bush and the bombing of Pan Am 103. The following is from For the Record program number 228. Let me note that the publication date of the copyright date of the book Gideon's Spies is misstated here. It's actually 1999, not 1989. This is from For the Record program number 228.
George Bush's name has, of course, been at the very center of the Iran-Contra scandal. Not only was George Bush not out of the loop, but as we looked at in material from the book The Secret War Against the Jews by Mark Loftus, by John Loftus and Mark Ahrens, George Bush's private intelligence agency, the Interagency Governmental Networks, put together as a result of the recommendations growing out of the Vice President's Task Force on Combating Terrorism, were in fact the main vehicle for affecting the Iran-Contra scandal, as well as the Iraqgate affair that overlapped it. In the book, research credit on the following also goes to a member of the listening audience who researched that last item for us. This is from Iran-Contra, the Final Report by Lawrence E. Walsh, Independent Counsel. This edition is published by Times Book, a division of Random House Incorporated, and it reproduces Volume 1 of the Office of Independent Counsel document in its entirety. Some of the remaining questions that Lawrence Walsh, the Iran-Contra Special Counsel, had for George Bush involved the following. Reading from the Iran-Contra final report, Independent Counsel's continuing investigation exposed evidence that called into question previous statements made by Vice President Bush concerning his knowledge of and involvement in the Iran-Contra matter. The purpose of a second interview with Bush was to resolve inconsistencies. The second interview would have focused primarily on these areas, and then skipping down, Bush's meeting with Israeli official Amiram Nir in July of 1986, particularly focusing on Secord's recollection that after Bush's report of this meeting, Reagan authorized the resumption of the Iran arms sales. So please note that one of the questions that Lawrence Walsh had for George Bush involved a meeting with that Bush had with Israeli Israeli official Amiram Nir in July of 1986, focusing on Richard Secord's recollection that after Bush's report of this meeting, Reagan authorized the resumption of the Iran arms sales. Now note the following detail. This research for us by the same listener. This comes from the book Gideon's Spies, The Secret History of the Mossad. That was authored by Gordon Thomas. It was published by Thomas Dunn Books. This is a subsidiary of St. Martin's Press. This book was published in March, copyright 1989. And there's discussion in here of that particular meeting at the King David Hotel in Tel Aviv. This involved, in Jerusalem, excuse me, this involved the meeting between Amiram Nir and George Bush. Please note that there is speculation here that Amiram Nir, who died in a plane crash, may very well have been killed in order to avoid the resulting embarrassment to George Bush. This Amiram Nir was killed in a private plane crash in Mexico. Please note that a couple of other people who died in a plane crash in a not too long after that were also allegedly at this meeting. Reading now from Gideon Spies by Gordon Thomas, we find, increasingly, Mossad believed that the CIA had murdered Nir. According to Ari Ben-Menashe, quote, Israeli intelligence has always believed it was a well-executed CIA operation. Nir's death ensured that there would be no embarrassment for Reagan and Bush at the trial of Oliver North, unquote. Support for this theory came from a U.S. Navy commander who had accompanied Nir to Tehran on the fruiterer's mission to free the Beirut hostages. The commander's story revolved around his claim that Nir had met with George Bush, then vice president, on July 29, 1986 at the King David Hotel in Jerusalem to brief him about the ongoing sale of U.S. arms via Israel to Iran. According to the writer Joel Bainerman, quote, Nir was secretly taping the entire conversation, and this provided him with evidence linking Bush to the arms for hostages deal. At the meeting were McKee and Gannon, who would die in the Pan Am flight over Lockerbie. The allegation being here that Charles McKee and Mr. Gannon, members of the McKee team, military intelligence operatives who had been in Lebanon to locate the U.S. hostages, and who, according to the Pan Am Insurance Investigators report, the Aviv report, had learned of the connection between the Iran-Contra operators and Manzer El-Kassar, a Syrian arms dealer who was at the very center of the Iranian arms deals and who also secured East Bloc arms for the Contras, and who, according to the Pan Am Insurance Investigators report, was deeply involved in the bombing of Pan Am 103, McKee and Gannon and the McKee team were on their way back to the United States to blow the whistle about Manzer El-Kassar and his involvement with the Iran-Contra team when Pan Am 103 went down. And Manzer El-Kassar's name has been linked to that bombing in a number of different contexts. The insurance investigators report blamed it on him. Other investigative reports have linked his name to the bombing in other ways. Manzer El-Kassar, again a Syrian arms dealer, effected some of his Iran-Contra arms sales through various corporate fronts that were involved with some of the what I call the underground Reich, including the Merex firm founded by Otto Skorzeny and Gerhard Mertens, one of Skorzeny's wartime associates. So note here, according to the book Gideon's Spies, this particular meeting with Amiram Nir, who died later in a plane crash in Mexico, and also McKee and Gannon, who died in Pan Am, Flight 103, were these were people present at this particular meeting. Nir was certainly present, according to Ben-Menashe. He had taped, or actually according to writer Joel Bainerman, he had taped this conversation. McKee and Gannon were present at that particular meeting. Note that George Bush's involvement in that particular meeting was one of the focal points of Lawrence Walsh's investigation into the Iran-Contra affair. That, again, from For the Record program number 228. And this is almost the end of Side 1 of For the Record 510. Remember, Spitfire stocks all the CDs and lectures that I've done. www.spitfirelist.com is the website. Sister station WFMU stocked the For the Record programs. www.wfmu.org/Dave Emery is the main site. This concludes For the Record program number 510. Deadly Echoes, I Told You So, Part 2, being recorded on May 8th of 2005. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.